Basically, the way I've constructed the questions is to give a basic overview of how politics are run in the South in general. I mean, Alabama is like one case point, but Alabama is pretty much, you know, representative of the majority of the South. And you can answer other questions from, you know, your knowledge or your father's knowledge, or from what you saw from your father, or what you see for yourself, or likewise. So, everything that you gave me pretty much it goes along the same lines as what the questions are. Yeah. It's all, I'm trying to basically shape what the politician in the South is gearing towards. What kind of people he's trying to get elected by, the ones who win, who get elected, why, that kind of thing.
It's changed tremendously over the years.
I got it all weaved in, trust me. Okay. First question. How would you describe yourself as politically minded? Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative, populist, nativist, whatnot?
Well, I'm not sure. Of course, I was raised a Democrat, socialized as a Democrat, conservative Democrat.
Socialized meaning?
Well, you know, the political objects and political beliefs there that my father had, he passed down to me. So my socialization was a Democrat, but it was a conservative perspective there. The Democratic Party there had so many wings and divisions and shades to it for so many years, kind of like the Republican Party today. But they're going to have a hard time keeping them together. But, you know, you called yourself an Alabama Democrat to kind of distinguish between the liberal label that you generally associated with the National Democrat. But we were still Democrats because the Republican Party really hadn't emerged out here to any significant degree. And politicians that wanted to get elected to office were Democrats. So I knew I was a Democrat and I knew I was conservative. But I don't know. Nowadays, I'm probably a little bit more of a National Democrat, still a Democrat, a little bit more National Democrat than I was, maybe a little more, a bit more liberal than I was. But my father generally remained a Democrat, but a strong conservative Democrat. Basically, still before Republicans really had made their move in the state. In a significant degree, except for that isolated goal on the switch. But other than that anomaly, not really serious.
Okay. Okay, and that kind of refutes my second question. From a political aspect, what type of makeups do you feel you attract to, and why?
We'll have to explain that.
Okay, as far as constituents go, what kind do you feel that your platform would appeal to? Like, basically describe the people who would be voting for you.
For me?
Yeah, say you were running, we can even pick it, we'll read into the next question, okay? On the issues of the 60s and 70s into the 80s, from inherency standpoints on both race and agriculture.
Now, am I putting myself in my father's position?
You're just... Basically, it's not about your father or you as the politician.
In the 50s,
yeah,
or a politician in the 60s.
Yeah, like what type of people are you?
Now, the first one I answered from my own perspective. That's really not a winning perspective politically, though, in Alabama today. I'm just asking it from a personal perspective, the first place.
Okay. You can answer anything the way you want it. You know what I mean? It's not.
But
like,
I want to know what you want, though.
What I want is to know how people.
A winning politician would answer the question.
It's a winning or a losing. Like either way, I'm going to be able to tell the opposite. You know, I need to compare and contrast in a way, and I'll be able to.
Personally, you know, I'm probably not giving you credit for knowing enough. But I have the feeling I'm not sure that you might not know. But anyway, we'll go on with this for a while and see. But Personally, that's the way I would believe. Now, politically, the state is much more conservative than my personal view.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, let's go to the next question, and I can answer that if you want me to, like a winning politician, or I could answer that like, you know, if I were campaigning for office.
Uh-huh.
But I personally would believe, or as that's really not going to help you very much, so is it? You don't care what I believe.
Well, no, see, if you go and you run and you lose, mm-hmm. then that means that the people that were going to vote for you, they don't want you. And the reasons they don't want you are going to be clear and evident by the people who get elected. You know what I mean?
But I don't plan to run for anything.
I understand that. You don't have to. Okay, let's just get to the next question. And the inherency standpoint on race and agriculture, okay, those are two primary big things here. What types of triggers do those pull, and to who are they pointed to politically?
Well, basically, agriculture is synonymous with the, it used to be the Farm Bureau Federation, but it's out for now. They got out of the national organization. No. Alabama Farm Association and basically the alpha group there is for low taxes, keep the property tax there, basically present classifications there, current use deal there for all of this huge millions of acres the land and land.
There's discrepancies now, aren't there, with who wants to get taxed and for what,
yes.
as far as land goes, because they haven't really ever been taxed on property.
That's true.
Okay.
But anyway, I'll push for the status quo for a huge bill. Things which we keep the property tax as a law tax very low. And of course, they oppose that about what the papers refer to as the risk development of the reform element of people that have been that the tax structure should be shaped to provide a greater taxation to these elements who would escape paying for such a long time, primarily using it to benefit education through
mm-hmm.
local support for education, which is very little of a cost and time. But when you think of agriculture, generally, you think of that element represented there by keeping the property tax low, work in opposition or in kind of a coalition there with the business groups within the state, working there basically with the Republican, within the Republican Party. So there was that coalition on one side and the coalition the power on the other and the Democratic office open basically the black group.
But that's
what basically comes into my mind when I hear the word agricultural interest.
Okay. Okay. From a Southern majority voter turnout, beliefs, it looks as though the South and the two-party system were screwed, basically, after the New Deal. Okay? Like, it's just going to be, like, from what I understand from lecture and from reading and whatever my comprehension was that prior to the New Deal, everybody was Democratic in the South, basically since 1901 when they had the...
basically since 1875.
Yeah, whenever the Redeemers came in.
Redeemers came in, uh-huh. And basically Democratic since then.
And then the New Deal comes in, though.
And it's still Democratic.
But some people were kind of like, wait a minute, like they were like, well, we're... not beginning yet the state's rights.
Well, that's right.
Education.
It was a Democrat within again the conservative state rights faction
uh-huh.
of the Democratic mm-hmm. Party, and that raised its head. Well, there were many opponents, elected opponents, office-holding opponents in the South to the New Deal.
Uh-huh.
That's true. This element of state sovereignty, state rights,
yeah,
prominence of that all along. Mm-hmm. Of course, it really didn't get pronounced to basically a break with the New Deal until the Truman election in 48. But there were always elements of opposition.
Truman had a civil rights bill, is that right?
That's right.
And that would be like a no-no for the Democrats down here.
That broke the camel back. They said, I remember reading something that said, when I... Truman and Roosevelt there were saying the same thing on civil rights. How come you didn't break with Roosevelt and you break with Truman? And one old Dixiecrat said, well, Truman really means it. So it was always there, but Roosevelt was a wonderful politician. He could talk out of 12 sides of his mouth, you see. And basically, kind of like Clinton in a way, whoever he talked to last, you see, that was the position that he took. But he wasn't going to do anything significant or meaningful there for the Southern blacks because he was afraid of alienating or breaking up his winning coalition. But Truman was serious about it. But anyway, that was the break. Really no serious republicanism until, well, 28, you know. There was a break in the Solid South.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was because of
Al Smith.
Uh-huh.
But really no break other than that for Republican until 52.
But I love this stuff. I really do. Like, I have a real... It's only because I'm from up north, and I know pretty much how things run up there. And the way things run down here is kind of contrast. But at the same way, a lot of people... would think I look down on it, or from up north do look down on it, but I look at it like this is the way things are done. I'm interested to find out why, and I don't necessarily...
It's not as unique as it used to be.
Uh-huh.
I was at the Citadel in Charleston there last year, and we always have a conference on Southern politics, and we were sitting there talking, and hoping this was a serious proposition or not. It sounded pretty serious to me. Said Southern politics now is so ununique that we need to abolish this conference. There's no such a thing as Southern politics anymore.
Uh-huh.
And people there were basically in agreement. We have a nationalization of politics. Folks in Rhode Island are Republican just for the same reason that folks in Alabama are Republican. And the same goes for the Democrats that really in Massachusetts said same reason that Democrat. Oh, yeah, I think so.
I have a question about that, but I'll find out.
I think so, big time.
Big time? Okay.
That's what I say. It's a huge change.
This is really, like, basically exactly what you just said, and it's a question about... Okay, because that has to do with what I think then. The South is politically contended for, okay, as a pawn in the scheme. Like, are they like, the way I look, I want to know how, in your opinion, national politicians would try to appeal to the South. Do they appeal to the South as part of the contiguous United States? Like, we're trying to get this, it's like, just like the West, just like the North, or would they try to appeal to, like, a certain criteria that the South might have for them?
And I, you know, back then in the 60s, there was a Southern strategy created for the Republic. President Nixon's Southern strategy. It felt the power to be in the Republican Party felt that if Nixon could convert the South of the Republican Party to become a majority party in the land. So, yes, there was a strategy. Again, there in the 60s, and to single out the South as a target for conversion to the Republican Party. Of course, Nixon there, well, I don't know how obvious he was, but it was very obvious, but he was also basically a fairly consensus politician. He wasn't so obvious that he alienated, you know, his northern constituencies there, who were good mainstream Republicans. Now, there was a book published before the Clinton election. Just almost simultaneously, that they called The Bible of South, by probably the most prominent scholars in Southern politics today, Earl and Merle Black. They both are in renown. But anyway, their contention was that the South plays a pivotal role in the national election. But whichever party gets the Southern vote is going to win. Of course, the 92 election kind of debunked their theory because Southern votes split, Southern electoral votes split. Now, of course, we know that Bush got the majority, as Republicans have been, but Clinton carried in four states, I believe, maybe four, I believe, for good matter. So their perception there really didn't hold water, that the South could act as a unit and determine their impressions.
But until that time, though, it
seemed to be working that way, yeah. But it didn't work that way in 92. Kind of like, though, the South elected Jimmy Carter, you know, and the South elected there was another election, I can't even forget. But you're right. In other words, the South has played a pivotal role. If Jimmy Carter had been a Northern Democrat, he would have lost.
Yeah, but he was from Massachusetts.
He would have lost.
He wouldn't have had...
That's right.
Yeah, and the Southerners would probably deem him as being like an imposter to Southern values if he said all those things that he said.
So, anyway, yes, the
and
South
the fact that his race policies, even, they would discredit him because of those. Because he was from the North, they would look at it like he was from the North and had race policies.
The South had functioned as a bloc.
Okay.
Yes. But as I say, the 92 punctured a hole a little bit in that theory because that was something to over the bush. But I'm not so sure. I'm thinking, you know, we we're in the middle there of what the Republicans started, not in the middle, probably maybe even toward the end of it. But what the Republicans started predicting there as early as 64, that we are in a realignment that's going to create a Republican majority in the land. And the South, of course, is a vital part of that majority. That could very well come to pass.
I think Republicans are, in my opinion, they changed their face too much.
Very well come to pass.
Yeah. Okay, when talking about education as a political standpoint, what is stressed to voters about that?
Well,
when you want them to get, like, when you're like, I want to be elected because, and this is what you're going to do for education, because some people, like the fundamentalists per se, or the holiness, all the Pentecostal churches, they're like, well, we don't want to learn about specific things. They want to go to places that basically teach you about stuff that you don't really need to know anymore. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, in a way, I do know what you mean. It's a very, very... I don't know, I was talking to some guy this morning there that's running this congressional race
in Jacksonville?
Yeah, for one of these candidates running in Old Browder's district. And they just got like a poll, and they were talking about the number one priority there of these voters is education. I said, we've got to be real careful there, you don't know what that means. Whether they want to cut all the fat in education, whether they want to get more money to education, or whether they believe that, you know, the teachers there ought to have the teacher test says. In other words, you know, Bob James won the first election there saying he was going to be the education governor in 1978, but he didn't tell the voters that he was going to, you know, cut education. A lot of folks voted for Bob because they thought he was going to try to improve education and not...
I have a letter. Let me see if I have it with me.
Cut all the funds, you see, to education. So it's very difficult, you see, to what you probably would need to do. And education there has gotten, as you say, a very hot issue lately between the fundamentalists of the, I hate to say religious right, but anyway, the fundamentalists of religious right. idea, you see, that you've got to include at least some type of integration between the church and the state. Folks have it, and they're basically supporters of private education, and these vouchers, you see, that we give money there to private schools.
Clinton acted that, or was it a...
Clinton basically was for a voucher for public schools.
Okay.
But he's not for a voucher for private school. In other words, you can take your money and go to any public school you want to.
He
supported
that. Yeah.
But the Republicans are the, religious conservatives, whatever you want to call them, and they are much...
It's not slandering them if you say that, because they'd probably be happy if
they... Well, maybe they would. But they want the voucher to extend to the private school as well. But that's going to be... I'm not sure that debate's going to touch Alabama for a while. You know, basically, Bob James is kind of the titular leader of that group of people, and he doesn't seem to be very interested, well, at least in raising a lot of controversial issues right now. I know that he attacked abortion, but he's not forcing the confrontation. He's just basically putting into the Alabama abortion bill some of the various collection of restrictions that are found in other states. I don't see him being confrontational on social issues. I don't see that coming out of, you know, being a big issue in Alabama there for the next few years anyway. But it is in other southern states, I know already, but for religious school. You know, I think basically the main issue dealing with education, and Governor James has picked up, we want to make sure that we get quality education at the lowest possible cost. In other words, we don't want to have to pay any more taxes for anything that we get. We're willing to fund the current level funding, but we want more for what we're spending.
Mm-hmm.
We want greater accountability. We want fewer bureaucracies. We want basically a coordination of purpose for the post-secondary schools. That seems to be there, rather than any great increase in spending. Use your money more wisely than we're already giving you. So, that's basically what I see, the direction of educational issues going to be. You know, no great big increase in taxes to increase education revenue. That's not entirely what we want.
Wouldn't be very popular, but I think it would be very purposeful. I think personally,
I think you might go with the increase in this property tax, as you see.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't object that to increasing the income tax. It may get more progressive. You know, a lot of folks don't like the flat tax, but I personally feel that the greater income, the bracketing income, you see, that ours is mildly progressive. I think, you know, maybe it goes from maybe the cap is 5%. I don't object to taking much more of that from the upper income group. So I think we could maybe increase the progressivity of the income tax plus increase this property tax rate at the local level. And I certainly don't think that hurt anybody in the country. But it's not popular.
At the local level, you say?
It's not popular anywhere.
Yeah. I know in Pennsylvania we use property taxes to fund education, but it's local, and that's why where I come from in the suburban area of Philadelphia, we had like top of the line, we had Macintosh computers like for every student in an English class, say 30 of them, if they need to go use them. You get out in Philadelphia, they don't even have like, you know, old IBM Apples from like 1980 in the city because the property down there is only worth, you know, $20,000 a shop,
yeah,
something like that. And
that's right. Well, and I see y'all have a greater disparity than we do. Basically, most of our money comes from the state for education.
Uh-huh.
They have what they call a minimum program fund. And I'm not sure the percentages on this, but a vast portion of of the per pupil expenditure in each one of these counties comes from the state. Some of the wealthier counties there supplement the state with the local taxes, sales taxes or property taxes, basically property taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there the wealthier counties spend a lot more there for students, educating individual students, than do the poorer counties. But as the bulk of the money comes from the state, the discrepancy is really not that great. You know, a lot of people make it out to be very great, but it's not nearly as good as it is in Pennsylvania. You see, where the locals provide most of the money. If the locals provided most of the money here in Alabama, there'd be a big gulf between down in Black Belt, Alabama, and in Mount Brook. But that's not the case.
It's almost like too late to even reform a system like that.
It is, and there's not going to be any more state money because we already are we're not at the top, but we're near the top in state contribution. But the local folks not pulling their share.
Uh-huh.
So if we have any, you know, reform, any change, any additional revenue, you know, the general feeling is it needs to come locally.
And nobody wants to do that.
No, because they don't want to pay any more property tax.
Right.
You see.
If any at all.
If any at all.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's not a real... You talk about how wonderful quality education, but you talk about reducing the fat, eliminating fat, you know, and unwise spending in education. You talk about accountability. Folks are totally convinced that the schools have, you know, completely messed up. The teachers are no good. The principals are worthless. And that they need to have some crap beat out of them or something, you know. They don't want to believe any more money's going to help that situation, you see. The voters are very, very wary of people that ask for more money.
Well, I can tell you that I went to a community college up north before I came here, student population there. The mean age was 35, I guess, because they had, you know, non-traditional students and whatnot. But the person... personalness that I had with the professors that I had wasn't nearly as close as it is down here, and there's more students down here and then professors. I'll tell you, I've never had a better education in my whole life, and I had a 2.4 CUM coming down here with 60 credits, and last semester I got a 3.2, and this is a harder college. It's not like this place is easier, and it's not like, you know what I mean,
I feel the same way you do. I really believe that we do very well for what we spend on education. These schools do pretty well. We write about it, the national average in the student test exam. We spend a lot less on education.
You know,
but we've got some very fine teachers here. And another thing here, of course, you've got a high black population, and traditionally they brought the stores down because they, you know, segregate, whatever reason they
Can I get this off my chest about that?
Yeah, for whatever reason you've had to spend a lot of time and money to pull the people that were, you know, just neglected for so long, pull them up.
That's exactly it. My standpoint on it, okay,
yeah.
The stereotype goes, you know, stupid blacks, whatever, in schools, whatever, it even goes through up north. But I think, you got 1,000 years of Western education coming over to the New World, right when they had, like, the first colony in Virginia, they brought slaves over. 1,000 years of education bred into those people's minds, and then you bring Bushmen over here who have not a thought in the world about education, words, you know, or like even a language or the whole way Western society works, and then you have them here for 400 years and they're slaves, they're not educated or taught anything, and then all of a sudden you're like, well, look, we've been denying you everything, you know how to speak English, go out and make your way. What are they going to know how to do? Inherently, what are they going
to
know how to do? They don't.
Oh, check. Is that all right?
Right. And it's like, you can't blame them.
Well,
you can only
right.
blame yourself.
And you have to work hard if you can, changing it.
Uh-huh.
And it takes a while and it takes money, but they haven't given us the money to do it. Mm-hmm. But yet we perform very well at the national average on these student test scores. So I think that we're doing pretty well in accountability aspects. We're spending our money pretty well. But you can't convince the voters of that. Mm-hmm. They think it's waste.
It's because they can't see it.
Big time.
Uh-huh. Mrs. Norton of the English department, she told me when she was a teacher in Gadsden City Schools, she used to have to buy her own supplies.
Yeah,
in the 50s
I did too.
And
I taught over there in 65. They didn't even buy paper for them.
Uh-huh.
We're doing much better than we were. That's why I guess the public resents it, you see. A lot of the public doesn't make the, I'd say the per capita, well, I'm not sure what it is, but it's a lot of it's teachers make. Teachers make a fairly good living.
Really?
Yeah. Well, in Alabama, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
In Pennsylvania, it might not be so high.
The starting salary of a teacher with a bachelor's degree in my high school got $23,000 starting, and then they work on a lockstep system, which is 10% more every year until they retire when they average the last 3 years of their salary together, and that's their pension.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty good for the end.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But in the beginning,
it's not very
good.
But anyway, y'all's per capita income is much higher than ours, and I would assume that you know, teachers do better, relatively speaking, here than they do up in Pennsylvania. And a lot of folks here there that make less resentment. It's not a very fertile ground to raise anymore.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And politicians don't talk about it either, about raising more money. Education.
Unless it's asked of them, and they probably skirt around.
And then they try to skirt it quickly, straddle 10 fences and talk out of every part of their mind.
This is going to be a little bit off the thing of education, but I think we covered it pretty well. Your father was Lieutenant Governor for Wallace, you said, right?
That's right. He was the first time for persons. That'll be in there. That's the governor between the two folds of administration. And then he ran for governor in 54 against Governor Folsom and lost, and then came back and ran for lieutenant governor, and Governor Wallace ran for governor.
Okay.
That's right.
How old were you at that time?
The first of July. I was in the 11th grade.
Okay.
So how would I be 16 or 17? 16.
Yeah, around that age. What effect did that have on you? I mean, you were, I guess, a local kid, you know what I mean? Like your dad?
Almost none, other than just get to go to Montgomery every summer. The legislature used to meet in the summertime, and you just, my mother had died when I was 10.
Uh-huh.
And so basically, you know, he carried me with him. Almost everywhere he went, I got to sit there and watch it all.
I mean, did you find yourself, like, a lot of the stuff, pardon me if I come from, like, a point of view from maybe liberal, but more than likely just a hot-headed,
I'm
like, 24-year-old. To see those things that were going on back then, the only things that I really consider to be issues for myself, like, I'm sure there was other primary issues, but one of the biggest ones was race, and the way that was handled by Wallace. Was that the way your father felt about it? Was that the way he made you feel about it, or you felt about it?
I don't know. I tell you two things, and you're the only person I've ever told this. He said, "Jimmy, don't ever tell anybody how I feel about this, but because you know it will just kill me politically. But I'll tell you." Now he did. Governor Wallace said, adopted the strategy kind of like they did in Mississippi and Barnett. Said, "Now I need to go to Tuscaloosa." At least said this was what he pronounced open to make sure there's no violence.
To Wallace,
that's what.
Okay.
I'm going to Tuscaloosa to make sure there's no violence like there was over.
You're talking about 62, right?
I'm talking about the integration.
Okay.
That's fine. Integrated over this. I'm going to Tuscaloosa.
Okay.
All right, now he was elected in 62, but Ole Miss was 62. Alabama, which was in 63, but in Democratic Party. So, a lot of folks there, the progressive thinkers, or whatever you want to say, when I said, now that George, you know, maybe he should go down there. Because, you know, we don't want anybody killed like they did over there in Mississippi. And so, anyway, George went down there, told everybody in Alabama, you stay away. Don't come to Tuscaloosa. I'll take care of you. Mm-hmm. Now, my daddy, you know, a lot of the people felt over George's grandstand. It's time to, you know, they really didn't know what was in his mind. But he was going to refuse to leave, had to be carried off, be put in jail, or what. And nobody had any idea. We even talked there about, well, now, Daddy, if George goes to jail, will you be governor of Alabama? And Daddy said, well, now, Jimmy, it just depends on where they put George in jail. The Alabama Constitution says if he's out of the state for 20 days, then I'll be acting governor. But anyway, you know, so anyway, we talked about that. And then George asked Daddy to go down there with him, and Daddy said, no, George, if somebody's got to stay here and mind the store. So they kind of split that, you see. George wanted to make a big play on it, get a lot of publicity. I don't really know, though. The motive in his heart was probably a dual one. I think probably he wanted to honor his campaign for segregation. Plus, though, could have been, though, that he wanted to do what he said, to prevent any violence going on. But anyway, Daddy and Wallace broke at that point in time. They never run as a team down here anyway, but, you know, they try to get along pretty well because the lieutenant governor really is in control of the Senate. And if he and the governor have to loggerheads, and the governor's program has a very tough time getting through. And not only the governor would suffer politically, but the lieutenant, people expect them to cooperate and work together and get something done.
Well, that's why one's governor and one's lieutenant governor.
So that's the way it's supposed to be. So anyway, but they kind of spit back, you know, and then I'm not sure. A lot of the people, though, at the time spent with Wallace over that standing in the schoolhouse. So more Southern officials or more Alabama officials opposed it in one might think. But even, you know, today Wallace said the only reason he went down that basically was to give the people. You want to buy that? That's fine.
See,
you don't
want
to buy that? That's fine too. Okay.
What were you thinking in your head when you knew he was going
okay.
down there?
I thought myself, I said, well, you know,
this is back then, like if you were, if you had,
back
you know.
Then, back then, we drove by the Carver High School. Every day I went to my high school, Garrison High School. And I don't know, we always, it was just always so run down, looked so dilapidated. There was a feeling there amongst my friends that, you know, the black people deserve what we have. They don't need to be at an inferior, and they say that the same school, but they don't need to have inferior school. They need to have the same quality school we had. You shouldn't have leaks in the room, you know, because you could see the school just
running down,
mm-hmm. It's neglected. So anyway, they really didn't have any black colleges to speak. They did, but you know, never heard of over years ago. So anyway, we were all sitting around there, and they said, you know, Jimmy, said, if I were black, I'd be out leading these marches too. Because, you know, they...
Is that what he's not supposed to tell anybody?
That's right.
Okay.
Said, the black people are, if I'd been mistreated like the black people had all over the region, I'd be at the forefront of this. I said, that, and I believe that's right. He said, but Jim, this is a problem that's going to take a long time.
It is.
It's still, I told
him. It still is, I don't know. But I don't know. You know. Richmond Flowers, some of the folks there in office at the time, he was the Attorney General, stood up and opposed Wallace. Called Wallace all kind of names there and stood up for the black civil rights. I don't know if he marched without him. But anyway, he positioned himself there for struggle, the vanguard there for equal treatment there and rights for the blacks. But boy, he was just ridiculed, abused. You've seen stories there, I don't know, but they've made a movie about him before Richmond Flowers. And so he was just politically dead ever since then, because he spoke out against Wallace. Anybody that spoke out very loudly. Daddy Wallace said, my daddy was so lucky. He opposed Wallace so many times, but he was always able to claw his way back. Mm-hmm. But it was clawing.
Oh, I'm sure. And it must have been manipulating in a way. Tricky.
It was tricky.
Uh-huh.
So he probably didn't. He didn't do like Flowers. That was not his choice, to stand publicly against George Wallace. But, you know, kind of, he felt it. Wallace, but, and told Wallace, you know, and told in Time magazine, he said, George, I'm not going to Tuscaloosa. I'm staying here to mind the store. So, yes, that publicly for Wallace, he doesn't screw my store, but didn't break publicly with him on segregation.
Okay. The KKK in politics at one time was very real and very prevalent.
Not in my memory.
Okay.
Now that basically was in the 20s and 30s, and even possibly extended or spilled over some of the 40s. Now some people disagree.
That's what I'm saying. You think?
But I believe I'm right.
Okay. Now, if it's not anymore, what changes do you think were brought about that made it so that it's like that, so that it was?
They just got a bad press. People don't like extremists. Nobody likes extremists, whether they're way left wing or way right wing. There are very few extremists out there that people like to be associated with. I don't ever, you know, generally speaking, it's just too much. That's why these say die. It's just too much. Basically, Southern people like you or wherever are good, decent people. That mess that they pulled out here is too much. Nobody believes. The vast majority don't believe in that mess. Therefore, you know, as long as you don't go out to club somebody or burn the house down or something, you're an organization that's political and you stand in for anti-blacks, anti-foreign, or anti-whatever, but you don't have to go out and do anything. Until when you know that fact, you know, those Jews, Carol, gosh, I see the plan, you know, they stand up for white folks. When the plan started going out there, you know, and killing folks, burning things down, you know, beating blacks up. And that's, oh.
Mm-hmm. There was even we were in lecture once, Professor Jackson, he said that in Tennessee, he said, I don't remember the name, he said, but there was somebody who was like a Jew store owner in Tennessee. They had a KKK march through there, and everybody was like, we hate Jews except for you, you know, to the store owner.
Yeah.
Because, like, anybody on a local level, like, if you knew them, like, they were a Jew, but they weren't really, like, it doesn't,
it's
like,
not.
Their makeup didn't matter, you know, because you knew them, and it was, like, you know, a personal thing.
And as long as everything, though, was, as you say, you could just, you know, hear about it. Oh, yeah, read about it, think about it. If you didn't see it in practice, discrimination, hatred, it's okay. But when they started really getting ugly, not interested.
Okay. That's good. I'm glad to hear that. I really am. What aspects of xenophobia hold merit for industry, religion, civil rights, education, etc., in the 60s and through today? We can break that down. I have other questions about it, like, say, for example, industry. Because what I noticed is that industry and government are kind of interrelated when it's upper industry. But at the same time, the governments down here want to stay far away from federal government. But the industry would look at the state government, or it should, like, that's a little federal government. Okay, and the industry itself is like a state government, so they want to be independent. But yet one can't run without the other, and it's just, I don't understand why.
Well, that was probably the hardest one. I really to really be authoritative on that form. I don't know how. I do know that there was discrimination on race and religion. I do think that. I don't know if there was discrimination about religion, about Jews or Catholics. I wasn't aware of it if there was.